calling for a rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded. Here's Tom Hartman.
Greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you, broadcasting live on radio stations from California to North Carolina, beaming down from outer space on the Sirius satellite radio system, coast to coast and border to border, and beaming around the planet on radiopower.org, whiterosesociety.org, podcasting, actually, there, and also on American FM, Live 365, and in cable systems in 29 states on CRN Digital. Welcome to our program. We are broadcasting live today from the campaign from the Take Back America Take Back America conference, right?
Right.
Yeah.
That is sponsored by Campaign for America's
Campaign
Future.
For America's Future. I've been doing it for 3 hours now here on the local program, and it's Ellen Miller is with us. She is the deputy director of the Campaign for America's Future that puts on the Take Back America conference. And welcome to the program, Ellen.
Well, thanks very much. I'm a huge fan of Tom Hartman, so I'm delighted to meet you in person.
Bless you. Thank you. What brought about, first of all, before we get to the conference, tell us a little bit about the Campaign for America's Future.
Well, Campaign for America's Future was founded in the mid-90s, 96, 97, with the goal of building a progressive movement to provide the infrastructure, the message, the policies, and to really galvanize what we know to be true, which is that most people in the country actually agree with progressive values and our programs, in fact. And so the question is, how do you translate that into real political power? And that is really the purpose of Campaign for America's Future and our sister organization called the Institute for America's Future.
Now, there was a time in America where what today are considered progressive ideas and considered even by, I want to say, mainstream folks, you know, in quotes anyway, like Chris Matthews, for example, to be radical ideas, that they were normal. You know, that it was in the 1930s, for example, it was a given that democracy in the workplace was just as good as democracy in government. That workers should have some say in how and whether and if and when they worked. As you know, and thus we had the Wagner Act passed in 1935, and the birth of the American middle class, and now these values have been co-opted. I'm wondering to what extent the Campaign for America's Future came out of the emergence of Bill Clinton's Democratic Leadership Council back in the early 90s. The simple reality is that 20-year unrelenting war against the American middle class and organized labor, starting with Ronald Reagan, had cut the labor ranks from, it was 25% of the nation was unionized when Reagan came into office. It's 8% now, 8.5% of the private workforce. And so Clinton was looking around saying, you know, well, where can we find money if we can't get it from labor? Well, let's go to the corporations. And suddenly we have Republican light in the form of the DLC. Were you formed as a response to that, or more in a vacuum of what happened to the progressive values of the 30s?
Well, in Washington, there's no such thing as a vacuum. But I think our formation really comes out of the need to, not as an opposition to the DLC or the more moderate Democratic wing of the Democratic
Party. I'd say so-called moderate, if I may. All right.
But we really come out of the need for, you know, to look towards the long-term infrastructure counter to what the Republicans have done, what the right wing has done in terms of building, you know, strong institutions, you know, from think tanks to the media outlets to action tanks to the whole thing. We are much more in direct opposition to what the right wing has done and attempting to build that infrastructure with many other organizations now as a counterweight to that, to take the political power back where it belongs, which is where most of the American people are. As I said, they share our values. People are turning against Washington now. They have buyer's remorse. Many of them may have voted for Bush, but that's not where their hearts and heads are. They know that they don't have good jobs. They know they don't have health care that's affordable. And those people, you know, should be on our side. And so our goal is to work to create a citizens' movement, a progressive movement that will lead the country.
And yet, just a moment ago, you were using their language. I mean, and this isn't a gotcha. This is where we're at. You said moderate Democrats, and they're not moderates.
Yeah, no, that's
right. They're not. They're radical conservatives, or they would have been considered that during Barry Goldwater's day.
Yeah, no, I was laughing when you were saying the things that used to be considered mainstream now seem
we're
like
the mainstream.
You know, progressive. But in fact, our ideas are mainstream. I have the honor of giving the Tom Paine Award tomorrow to Senator John Edwards. And so I was doing a little bit of research on Thomas Paine, the great patriot pamphleteer. It turns out that Thomas Paine, you know, back in the founding of the Republic, had some really radical ideas like guaranteed minimum wage, like Social Security for the elderly and the ill.
Did you read my op-ed on BuzzFlash about Tom Paine?
No, I have not seen it.
I do a monthly book for BuzzFlash, a book review. This month's, it's up right now, is The Rights of Man by Tom Paine.
Oh.
And I deconstruct the book, and I've got all those quotes from him. And, yeah, it's go to BuzzFlash.com and just search on Tom Hartman, and you'll find it.
One of my favorite sites.
Yeah.
In addition to our own site, the Campaign for America's Future, hosts the TomPaine.com site.
Mm-hmm.
And I was the publisher of TomPaine.com, and we merged it into Campaign for America's Future.
That's marvelous.
So that's our daily outlet.
Yeah. Okay. So that's the Campaign for America's Future. Now, from the Campaign for America's Future has come the Take Back America conference.
That's right.
Tell us about the genesis of that, and then about what you're doing here, or we're doing here now.
Well, the genesis of the conference started actually, I think, 4 years ago. When the co-directors of the campaign discovered that there was a need to convene progressives, to bring the community together, and it has grown every year since that. This year we're expecting 2,000 people to come together to develop the sort of unity, to think the big thoughts and the ideas that will take this this progressive movement forward. To do trainings and, you know, the whole host of activities that we have planned here.
Right.
And so it really is an opportunity to bring people, not just Washington-based policy wonks, but people from all around the country together and create, you know, a kind of energy and a kind of enthusiasm. And if people are feeling depressed, to remind them what the polls say about, you know, where people are.
We are the moderate majority! Excuse me.
We certainly can use you as a measure of our enthusiasm.
By the way, Ellen's going to be with us another 5 or 6 minutes if you have a quick call or question. Our number, 1-866-889-8894, toll-free nationwide. And if you want to drop into our live chat room, which is already well-populated with folks from two continents, I see, go to TomHartman.com and click on live chat. Ellen, we're speaking with Ellen Miller, the Deputy Director of the Campaign for America's Future that puts on the Take Back America conference. So those are the goals of the conference. What's going on with the conference here?
Well, there's a lot going on, and we have a 25-page agenda, essentially,
mm-hmm.
starting today, talking with Bob Borisage, one of our founding directors, talking about the big ideas, where the public is. We lead into sessions about what it will take to take the country back from a more political perspective.
Right.
We'll be looking at economic issues. We'll be looking at the most corrupt Congress in recent memory, perhaps the most corrupt Congress ever. We have big-name speakers like Bill Moyers and Arianna Huffington. Senator John Edwards will be here at lunch tomorrow. So it really is, a breath of our best and our brightest, both activists who are attending and leaders who will be speaking.
Great, great. And you mentioned the most corrupt Congress in history.
I did.
Let me just give you an opportunity to rant about that for a moment.
Well, I mean, one hardly has to say any more than that. I think of that analogy, like with fish, the rot starts from the head.
Right.
Think about Tom DeLay. Think about his, four ethics citations, violations by the Ethics Committee. The way he sort of personifies the sleazy relationship between money, politics, lobbyists, getting things done, for a right-wing corporate agenda. We've looked, but he's not alone. I mean, he is sort of the essence of it. And we periodically single out members of Congress and say, you are an emblem of the fundamental corruption. Our first target on this was a Representative Jim McCreary. He's the head of the Social Security Subcommittee. And he takes a couple $100,000 from Wall Street. Now, how can anybody think that he's going to have a fair opinion on the president's plan to privatize Social Security?
Or obviously, the bankruptcy bill.
Or the bankruptcy bill. Or, any piece of legislation that goes through. This Congress is, up to their eyeballs and beyond in political money that comes from interested sources, and it's corrupted them, the institution, and fundamentally, of course, it's corrupted our democracy.
Right. Much to the detriment of all of us. Jay in Atlanta is on the line, 1-866-889-8894, a telephone number. Hey, Jay, you're live with Ellen Miller, the Deputy Director of the Campaign for America's Future.
Hey, sounds like you're doing some important work. I wish there were more people like you. What I was really wondering about is the rally that's coming up in September. Like, who's going to be in charge of communications director for that?
The rally coming up when?
In September. There's supposed to be a big anti-Bush rally.
Oh, yeah. There's a bunch of stuff actually coming up in September. I'm not sure specifically which one you're talking about, Jay, but drop me a note or send me something. This is not, that would not be an event that the Campaign for America's Future is putting on, right? So, I'm sorry.
Ms. Miller?
Yes?
If we impeach Bush, of course, that would have to include Cheney and the whole administration. I was just wondering about the vacuum of leadership that would occur if that took place. Is anyone addressing that?
First of all, I think the likelihood of impeaching Bush through a Republican Congress is very, very minuscule. Not that there are not grounds certainly to consider it. The vacuum of leadership on the Democratic side, I think, doesn't exist. There are a huge number of leaders, many of whom will be at Campaign for America's Futures Conference. And by the way, a lot of this is being broadcast on C-SPAN. Mm-hmm. I know all the afternoon sessions are. There are a huge number of leaders, both in the House and in the Senate, and certainly in the think tanks and, you know, within the progressive infrastructure, who could more than easily, fill the vacuum. We wouldn't fill the vacuum. We would create, you know, such a powerful political force that they would never get it back.
Yeah. Jay, thanks a lot for the call. There's this mythology. It's really remarkable how effectively the cons get out their myths and how they get promulgated through the mainstream media of a vacuum of leadership in the Democratic Party or on the left. And how does this come about?
Well, they have an incredible message machine. I mean, they own the media.
Yeah.
So, you know, someone literally in a little shop in a basement someplace puts out talking points, and it is broadcast, you know, through talk radio, through paid media. It seeps its way into the mainstream media through pundits, etc.
Yeah.
And so it is really just an overwhelming message machine, and it is breathtaking how it works.
And now we see that tens, if not hundreds of millions of dollars spent in that machine are actually spent taxpayer dollars.
Well, of course. I mean, a big surprise there, right? I was going to say, let me add a positive note to this. I mean, what's happening here at this conference is we have created a progressive media row, which is filled with broadcasters like yourselves, progressive magazines. And so we are fighting back in terms of the control of the message. And we're going to do what they have done, but we're only going to do it better because people believe our message. We are not spinning people.
Because truth and justice are on our side.
Indeed, just as you said at the very beginning of our conversation.
Yeah. And it really is. It's so nice not having to sit here and go through the news and say, okay, what's my spin on this going to... But just, hey, here's what's going on, and take a look at this. I mean, can you believe that this is what they're doing to us? It's just remarkable. We've been talking with Ellen Miller, Deputy Director of the Campaign for America's Future. What's the website, Ellen?
www.ourfuture.org, and we will be podcasting from the website many of the speeches and interviews with various people as well, so please come.
Great. Ourfuture.org. Thanks so much, Ellen Miller. Tom Hartman here with you, 20 minutes past the hour.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friends. 24 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you, broadcasting live coast to coast from the Take Back America Conference in Washington, D.C. End the occupation of Iraq, says David Swanson. And let's do something about George W. and Downing Street. Hey, David, welcome to the program.
Hey, Tom, good to be here person in your studio.
There you go, our perennial guest, David Swanson. Which particular website would you like to plug today?
I would love to plug afterdowningstreet.org.
There you go.
Which has existed for 5 days and has seen over 100,000 people, so we're pleased with it.
100,000 people, not hits.
People, visitors.
Individual, oh, that's incredible. After Downing, D-O-W-N. ING Street, STREET.org. Maybe we'll get you another 10,000-20,000 there. Bang!
I bet you will.
And after DowningStreet.org, the minutes have recently emerged that Bush and Blair were planning a war, even though they knew that this country posed no threat to us. Now, I've been saying for some time that I'm of the opinion that this was not about oil, that we could have bought oil from these guys. Although there is an argument to be made that if they were to develop strategic arrangements with China, like Iran is doing right now, that maybe we couldn't have bought oil from them. And that if then Saudi Arabia and Qatar and Kuwait and all these other countries fell into the Chinese sphere, that what we're seeing is the early stages of a war of empires, shall we say. I'm not sure that that's the case. I don't discount that. But I think that the reasons for this war in Iraq were much more banal or banal, depending on what part of the country you're from, that really what they were trying to do was simply get back Republican control of the Senate and get George Bush Jr. elected for 2004. What's your take on this?
Well, I've heard at least a half dozen good theories what it was for, and the most convincing to me is that it was for more than one thing. The theory that is perhaps most relevant to the topic of afterdowningstreet.org is the theory that what they really wanted to do was thumb their nose at international law and shut down the effectiveness of the International Criminal Court before it could really get up and running, and they certainly did that.
Would this be so that it wouldn't ever come after them?
Well, the United States, unlike the situation Blair is in, the United States is not a member of that court and is not subject to prosecution.
Just like Hitler pulling Germany out of the League of Nations.
Exactly, exactly. But, you know, what we're doing with pointing to the Downing Street minutes is saying, look, here is in black and white in an official government document what all of these former Bush administration officials have been saying, what everyone has long suspected. We now have the smoking gun. We're not trying to prove what the war was for, just that it was for something other than what Bush told the American people and Congress it was for.
Right. And if people go to afterdowningstreet.org, they will have an opportunity to do what?
They will have an opportunity there to learn more, to read the Downing Street minutes, to read a proposal that Attorney John Boniface has sent to Congressman Conyers. They will have an opportunity to contact their congressmember, to contact Congressman Conyers, to sign his letter to the president, which he will deliver in person when he has 100,000 signatures, which he may do already.
It was 50,000 and climbing, I guess, on Friday, wasn't it?
I think so, and their site was getting shut down by traffic over the weekend, so it's got to be up there, but sign it anyway, and you'll have an opportunity in addition to contact your local media and to print out flyers to hand out at events. And we're trying to build a major movement, and we need everyone to be part of it, because we need not just the Democratic leaders but a majority in the House of Representatives.
Yeah, absolutely vitally important. Go to afterdowningstreet.org and get that information. This could be the Watergate break-in.
This is it. I mean, the Watergate
story. This is the smoking gun.
That took a long time to develop. I'm extremely happy that for whatever reasons the story about Deep Throat has come out now as an example to what really constitutes a hero for a government employee. But you know, this is it, and we need a resolution of inquiry. This is how we started with Nixon. This is how they started with Clinton. This gets it rolling.
Right, and the way to do that is to go to afterdowningstreet.org. Get involved with this thing. David Swanson, thanks so much for being with us today. Tom Hartman here with you, 29 minutes past the hour.
Hey, Bob.
Democracy to the United States of America. Here's Tom Hartman.
And who's gonna pay the bill? Who's gonna pay the bill? Not Rush Limbaugh, not George Will, not those chicken hawks on Capitol Hill, not the tax cut billionaires, you know the drill. You're gonna pay the bill.
And welcome back, my friends. Tom Hartman here with you, broadcasting live coast to coast, border to border. Robert Greenwald is with us. He is the noted television and film producer, a committed activist for democracy. That's a great way to say that. It is absolutely great. Robert, Bob?
Robert.
Robert. pleased to have you with us, Robert.
Thank you.
Producer, director of Uncovered, The Whole Truth About the Iraq War. This is your newest, is it not?
No, the newest is a film that was just announced today called Walmart, The High Cost of Low Price, which is going to be about Walmart. So
tell me about that.
Well, we've been working in secrecy for the last 4 or 5 months, as we did without Fox, by the way. We worked for months and months where Fox didn't know about it.
Brilliant piece of cinematography and documentary and reporting and activism. Anyway, I interrupted you.
That's okay. Always good to be interrupted with compliments. So the new film is a look at Walmart and all the various ways that it affects all of us. And the subtitle, The High Cost of Low Price, which is what we're paying in order for the low prices, whether it's our taxes, the destruction of jobs, the effect on communities. And we've set up our website, walmartmovie.com, and we're asking people to help us finish the film in a couple of ways. One is we want people to send us video. There have been communities all across the country that have resisted, and I know that people who have been fighting Walmart have been taking photos and show and DVDs and all kinds of ways of recording it, so they can send it to us at walmartmovie.com. Mm-hmm. We're also asking for photographs of, you know, when Walmart moves into an area and shops get closed and main streets get decimated, so we want photographs. And because we're having trouble finishing the film, we're asking people to help make contributions to get it done, too, and they'll get a free DVD in return for that.
Oh, that is so cool. You, too, can be a producer-director of your little piece.
There you go.
Of The High Cost of Walmart.
Right.
The upcoming movie by Robert Greenwald. What are now, go through a list of the movies that you've produced that some of our listeners might be familiar with.
Well, on the political side, the documentary side, it's been unprecedented. The Un trilogy, which was unprecedented, directed by Joan Sekler and Richard Perez.
Which I'm in.
That's right. You are, prominently, too.
Yeah.
That's when we first got together.
Yeah.
That was the first documentary, and then I did Uncovered about the reasons we were given for war in Iraq with a lot of CIA and foreign service people. And then after that was Outfoxed. And then Unconstitutional, about civil liberty. So those are the four documentaries that I've done. And then I've done a lot of narrative films, including Steal This Movie, about the life of Abbie Hoffman.
Yeah, I thought Unconstitutional was remarkable, I have to say. I do a monthly book review for BuzzFlash.com, Tom Hartman's Independent Thinker's Book of the Month, you know.
Yep.
And I proposed to Mark Harlan that movie be that month's book. And he said, we've been selling it for months. We're selling so many of them. Everybody already knows about it. We've already done a review of it. You know, and I was like, oh, I should have looked on the site. Right? Because when I saw it, it was like, holy cow, you know, we got to tell people about this. This is incredible. It was like, well, Marcus, we're already telling people.
Well, you know what's great about the films, I mean, I've discovered with each one, Tom, more and more, is they're really tools for organizing. Yeah. And your listeners are going to come up with a whole slew of ideas that I don't even have about how to use the films, how to get them. Because making the film is good, but that's just the beginning of it. It's only really meaningful if people figure out how to screen them, how to get people to see them, and most importantly, how to take action after seeing the film. So it's not a passive experience. It's an active experience.
Yeah, yeah. And that's so important. And now you've raised this active experience to an art form. I mean, to this with WalmartMovie.com. It's WalmartMovie.com website. What is the effect of Walmart coming into a community? I mean, you've been living this now for some time. In the middle of this, the conservative argument is that Walmart comes in, that they offer jobs to communities. I mean, I lived in Vermont through a period of time when we went from, as I recall, no Walmarts to four. I know of one battle in particular that was near us, and where Walmart ultimately won. And they won in large part because they were able to convince the local community that they were going to do something for the community. They were offering bennies, they were, you know, freebies and things. The community ended up giving them tax cuts and things, but nonetheless, that they were offering all these, and you know, we'll support the schools, and we'll do this and that, and by the way, we're going to provide jobs, and quack. What's the real story?
Well, first of all, I think there's an extraordinary opportunity here, both with the film and the organizing, because Walmart cuts across the narrow partisan political lines.
Yeah.
We have people in the film with NRA hats who voted for George Bush, and when they talk about Walmart, they sound like we do, because they can go in, they'll drive out the small family business, Walmart will over, I mean, thousands and thousands of them. The small family business folks are not people necessarily aligned with a progressive point of view, but on this issue, they understand Walmart, the large corporation, is the problem. People's homes, you know, middle class, low middle class homes where they put roads through, where they built Walmarts in backyards, people who are counting on their home equity and value to be the nest egg that they can retire from, decimated. Mm-hmm. They understand viscerally and intelligently Walmart is the enemy. So I really want to use the film, and I hope all the organizing, to reach across. Lisa Smithline, who's working with me on organizing, has lined up about 30, 35 groups already, including lots of churches from a religious point of view, and some of the small business associations who are opposed to us on almost every other issue. But here's one, there's a real coming together, because they've seen how it affects their community.
Yeah. Now, the point that I make on my program and in my writings about Walmart specifically is that the problem isn't Walmart, is that the problem isn't just that Walmart is bad people, they're evil, you know, it's this is the force or something like that, but rather that Walmart is doing what the rules allow them to do. And we didn't used to have those rules. In fact, we used to have the anti-rules. The Sherman Act, for example, of 1890 used to stand, and Ronald Reagan blew it off in the early 1980s. And so the rules have changed. I mean, historically, business is just a game where you keep track of who's winning and who's losing by how much money they make. And we've always said, if you want to play the game of business, that's cool. We're all in favor of that. We're a nation of business people. But if you're going to play the game of business, you're going to have to do it according to a set of rules that say you have to have some benefit to we the people, to the community, rather than at least a detriment, or at the very worst, it has to be neutral. And so I've always argued that it's not so much that we have to destroy Walmart or bring them down or even change them. We have to change the rules so that Walmart and every other company that does what they do, because they're only one of many, will then be forced to change their behavior because the rules change. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, I have two responses to that. Because Walmart is the biggest, mm-hmm, by far, you know, 1,500,000 employees, you know, hundreds of billions of dollars of income, when we change Walmart, it will affect change in all of the corporations. So I see it as a two-pronged approach. Right. One is what we can do is go after and force Walmart to change its bad behavior in a variety of different ways. But I completely agree with you. If it's not Walmart, then somebody else will come in. Until we create both rules and an environment that will encourage corporate citizens to say, I have a dual responsibility. My only responsibility is not to squeeze every last nickel I can in whatever possible way.
But that's their legal responsibility. I mean, the Supreme Court has ruled that if, as the head of a corporation, as a director or a senior officer, you fail to do everything you can to increase profitability and shareholder equity, you have failed in your fiduciary responsibilities. You've actually committed a crime that you can be prosecuted for. So how can we say to Walmart, stop squeezing every nickel out, when the law says that they have to, unless we change the law first?
Because I think that you can make a very strong and consistent argument that Walmart's, even its profitability, will increase if they begin to behave like a reasonable corporate citizen, if they stop abusive behaviors about their employees, about communities they go into, and about outsourcing. There's a coherent and consistent argument to be made that will help them in the longer run of showing profitability and in having communities accept them as they come in.
Are you talking about sort of like the Costco model?
I'm not as familiar with Costco as Walmart, but yes, people have suggested that strongly as one model. You know, again, I want to limit what I say because I know about Walmart a certain amount, having spent 6 months and another 6 months coming.
Right.
But I think we need to approach it both ways. I don't think we can just wait to change the laws, because the laws getting changed are often a function of social action.
Sure.
As in the case of mobilizing around something like Walmart. You know, civil rights changed all the laws because they said this is unjust, and then it led to other changes.
Right, right. So we do it all at once.
Yes, absolutely.
Sounds like a good plan. We have a caller, Armin in Florida, 1-866-889-8894, our telephone number, if you'd like to speak with Robert Greenwald and his new movie, which the title of which will be
Walmart, The High Cost of Low Price.
The High Cost of Low Price. WalmartMovie.com, the website, if you want to participate in that. Armin in Sarasota, Florida on the line. Hey, Armin.
Hey, I have a really interesting story. and it's true, and it's based on, we had a small family business in Illinois in the 80s, and my father started it right after World War II, and we sold mercury outboards and home light chainsaws, and we were a home light chainsaw dealer for 30 or 35 years in the early 80s, and what had happened in our small town is a Walmart-type entity moved to town, and they were selling chainsaws cheaper than our cost. So I finally went through the bureaucracy, and I got a hold of Textron, a CEO of Textron that owned Homelight at the time, and I explained the dilemma to him about how we can't compete, and we were a dealer when nobody else really wanted to be one, and helped build the company up and build the name and recognition up, and this was very unfair to have somebody come in that was not from the community and sell massively and put us out of business and sell cheaper than we could even buy them from them for in big quantities. And the CEO and I had a real good discussion. His attitude was this: Tom, here's the problem with this centralized advantage out of Washington that trickles down through the rest of the economic system and becomes predatory capitalism because it's not a level playing field for all the participants, because the distinct advantage is in the legislation that the federal people take money to furnish.
Yeah, I got it. I got it, Armin.
Okay, here's the deal. Here's the deal. So the deal is, he told me, he says, well, steel chainsaws is coming on strong, and John Surratt chainsaws are coming on strong, and we care about Textron, and we're not going to be here if we don't stop them, because they're coming in and they're so competitive when they're coming in.
So they were willing to sell below price, basically, to blow away the competition, because at the manufacturer level. Are you good point, Armin. Thank you for the call. Robert, is this, you know, this has got to be a multidimensional issue.
Yes.
It's not just about low prices. Oh, and the other thing that I wanted you to address, it seems to me that we're doing Walmart's work for them in one very big way. Every single time any of us get out there and complain about, for example, Walmart's labor policies, there are millions of people around America who hear that message and go, huh, Walmart's screwing their workers. Well, I don't work for Walmart, but that means that their prices are going to be cheaper, so I guess I'll go shop there. I mean, people who don't have a social conscience but are concerned about the price of things. And, in fact, the prices aren't always cheaper. And Costco, for example, treats their employees well, pays them a decent wage, and very often beats Walmart on prices. But the more we talk about their wage practices, the more we're convincing Americans that they actually have low prices and they should go shopping there, aren't they?
Not necessarily. You can talk about wage prices from the point of view of they are an unfair corporation.
Right.
That money is not going to lower prices.
It goes to the profit. It goes to the Walton family.
Exactly.
So every time we talk about Walmart screwing their employees, we need to make sure that in the same breath, in the same sentence, it's Walmart screws their employees so that they can add more profitability to the Walton family, which is in aggregate the four or five Waltonaires are richer than Bill Gates or anybody else.
$100 billion.
That they're sitting on.
None of them have worked a day in their life for.
Talk about, you know, sitting around the pool on your butt waiting for the dividend check to arrive in the mail as a way of making a living. I mean, this is
staggering.
And these are the folks for whom so many of our laws are being written.
Yes.
In fact, I mean,
well, they're subsidizing that. The Walton family is the biggest single supporter of changing the inheritance tax. If you had $100 billion, you could well understand it.
Interesting. I didn't realize they were so politically active.
Oh, yeah. A lot of that's going to come out in the film and some articles that are going to coincide with the arrival of the film.
Interesting. Let's take another call. Xavier in Santa Cruz, California on the line. Hey, Xavier, what's up?
Oh, hi. I wanted to point out, you're talking about avenues for screening movies and whatnot.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things that we do here in Santa Cruz is called Guerrilla Drive-In Theater.
Yeah.
And what we do is we get, they have these projection video monitors. They're used for computers, and you can put video from like a DVD player through them, and you can set them up in like common public spaces and provide free theater for people.
That's great. And do you encourage that, Robert? I know your movies are copyrighted.
Yes.
Thanks, Xavier, for the call.
Yes, very much so. In fact, if you could send me an email about that, I'd like to circulate that. Send it to walmartmovie.com or robertgreenwald.org. I'd like some more information about that and start to let people know.
To Xavier?
Yeah.
Okay. And now those are websites, not email addresses.
Well, you can email.
Visit the website, you'll get the email from them.
Right.
walmartmovie.org or .com. or robertgreenwald.org.
Or robertgreenwald.org. Okay, great. We have a little less than a minute left, Robert. What is the main take-home message that you want our listeners to have from this conversation?
That they are part of the solution, that the film is just the beginning, and that now it's in their hands, and I look, like with Xavier's ideas and others, mm-hmm. I look to them to take the film and make of it what I had no idea could happen in the ways that they will screen and use and organize and work for social change.
That's marvelous. Robert Greenwald with us. WalmartMovie.com, his latest effort, and some tremendous work that you've done up to this point.
Thank
I'm
you.
So pleased that you're on the planet with me, Robert. It's an honor to have
well, same back
to be here at the same chair with you.
And the work you're doing, keep up.
Thank you very much. It's the Tom Hartman Radio Program, 10 minutes before the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And welcome back, my friends. Tom Hartman here with you. Well, okay, greetings to our newest affiliate, by the way, Radio Free Ohio. Okay, greetings, friends, from Akron to Cleveland. So glad to be on the air there. Speaking of Ohio, a new scandal. The Center for American Progress reporting today, a new scandal is rocking conservatives in the Buckeye State for nearly a decade. Thomas Noe, I'm assuming it's pronounced Noe, N-O-E, has been one of the top wheeler dealers in right-wing Ohio politics. Today, he's under at least six investigations or audits involving shady investments or corrupt fundraising for political campaigns. Today, federal investigators are even looking into his contributions to the George W. Bush Jr. 2004 campaign, for which he was listed as a pioneer. This guy's a pioneer. In one remarkable case, Noe convinced the Ohio Workers' Compensation Bureau to invest $50 million in state money in a rare coin fund he owned. He made $3 million off the venture. The state, however, wasn't quite so fortunate. $400,000 worth of coins have just sort of vanished into space, you may say. Coins were lost in the mail, they say, and last week, Noe's lawyers admitted as much as $13 million of the fund's assets are similarly missing. Not necessarily in the mail, though. Where did this money go? We don't know. After all, it's Republicans. I mean, it could be anywhere. It could be... Yeah, you get it. For example, when a series of lawsuits seeking an inventory of Mr. Noe's coin investments were brought before the Ohio Supreme Court recently, five of seven justices were forced to recuse themselves. All had received campaign contributions from Noe. Well, at least in Ohio, the Supreme Court justices, five of the seven of them, who get money from somebody, recuse themselves from cases. Priscilla Owen, when she was on the Texas Supreme Court and had cases coming before her, before that court, that would have worked against the interests of Halliburton, one particular case, and another case that would have worked against the interests of Enron, suddenly both of those corporations decided it was time to get politically active. Time to make some campaign contributions. How about to Priscilla Owen, in fact, and Alberto Gonzalez? And neither one of them recused themselves. They took the money, and then they ruled in Enron's favor and in Halliburton's favor. So I guess I should say tip of the hat to the Ohio Supreme Court for at least five of the seven justices recusing themselves. A little more integrity in Ohio than in Texas, but unfortunately, that's not saying a lot when it comes to cons and Republicans. Tom Hartman here with you. The talk radio for the rest of us.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. He's the man who one covers corporate lies, exposes political corruption, and has a clear vision of what America could become. Here's Tom Hartman.
People of the United States of America, Tom Hartman radio program. Our telephone number, 1-866, toll free across the United States, 1-866-889-8894. If you'd like to drop into our live chat room, go to TomHartman.com. However you spell it, will get you there. TomHartman.com and click live chat. That will drop you in there, and you can participate in live interactive conversations with some of the finest minds on the planet. 1-866-889-8894. Our telephone number, Frank in Phoenix on the line. Hey, Frank, what's up?
Tom?
Yeah, you're live and on the air, Frank.
I was just wondering, I'm not trying to impugn on Robert Greenwald's reputation or anything, but does he have to go get permission from Walmart to do this movie or anything? And if so, then how can we know all the... Know what I mean?
I don't know why he would have to get permission from them. You mean because they would claim trademark infringement or something?
Exactly.
Yeah, I'm sure that they wouldn't have the ability to do that. There have been books written about McDonald's, for example. If you are using a brand name in a title, if you do a newspaper story, for example, about Walmart, and you put their name in a headline, that's simply reporting the news. Documentaries are exempt from those kinds of problems.
Oh,
so,
that's great. Thank you.
You know, yeah, you're welcome. Thanks a lot for the call, Frank. I'm sure that there's no way that Robert would do that thing if he had to go to Walmart and ask their permission. I just can't imagine it. Alec Dubrow is the media coordinator for the International Labor Communications Association, the ILCA, their website, ILCA Online. And, Alec, welcome to the Tom Hartman program.
Hi, Tom. I hear you're in town.
I am in Washington, D.C. You ought to drop by. I'm at the Take Back America Conference, which is the Center for America's Future. And it's just amazing. Bill Moyers is speaking, and Howard Dean. In fact, he's going to be on our program tomorrow morning. Lots of extraordinary folks lurking around here.
Well, Bill Moyers, Howard Dean, and now me.
There you go. So now Alec Dubrow. Alec, what's up with organized labor right now?
Well, I just wanted to bring up something that we had been looking into, and I ran across it, which is executive compensation versus worker earnings. And I ran across an article from the Orlando Sun Sentinel this Sunday by a guy named Richard Bedard, and the title is, As Average Worker Struggles, the Boss is Earning Even More. Now, that's not exactly a revelation, but to come out with something like that from the heart of Florida, I thought was worth looking at. And he starts it off saying, as most Americans struggle with disappearing pensions, a fraying Social Security safety net, and a sluggish stock market, the big bosses are still living large. Apparently, the message is beginning to filter down.
But, Alec, the flip side of this, I mean, you've got cons all over the country who are saying, hey, it doesn't matter what the bosses make. You know, they own the companies. They have the right to pay themselves whatever they want. How do you respond to that?
Well, it's a very interesting thing. If you actually spell out or count out the degree to which they're taking the money, there's a couple of issues. I mean, one is that it's been last year was the biggest jump in executive pay in 10 years. At the same time, white-collar workers lost compared to inflation. And if people say, yes, they have the right to take anything they want, well, this is very interesting. I want to give it a different take. I don't see this as excessive executive compensation. I call it corruption. When petty tyrants rake this much off the public till, we call it corruption. And I don't think many
But
Americans
this is the private till, Alec. These are private corporations. Forgive me for playing devil's advocate. I mean, I have my own argument against the things that I'm saying, but I'm curious about your take on them.
Okay.
These are private companies. Say you start a company mowing lawns in your neighborhood, and, you know, let's make it just really simple here, and you decide to pay yourself whatever you decide to pay yourself, as long as you've got the money in the bank to do it. What's wrong with that?
Nothing. Nothing in that case. That's a private company. But what these are, each and every one of them, is describing a publicly traded corporation.
So there's a difference.
Corporations are chartered for, indeed, not just profit, but for the public good. And so I think that there is a public component of it. Obviously, it's not strictly private, it's not entirely public, but it is a public corporation.
But it's been, really, it's been since the 1890s, during the charter-mongering era, when the states all started falling all over themselves to accept John Rockefeller after Ohio had declared what he was doing with the Standard Oil Trust to be illegal. And it's been since the 1890s when New Jersey, New York, Connecticut, Delaware, principally those states began the thing, started changing their corporate charter laws so that they no longer said that you have to serve the public good. I don't think that Delaware's corporate law, for example, which is the state where more than half of the Fortune 500 companies are chartered, the Delaware's corporate law requires that you operate to the public benefit. I think in my recollection, I could be wrong on this, but I'm pretty sure I'm right. I've started four Delaware corporations in the last 30 years, is that Delaware's corporate law says that you must do whatever is lawful in Delaware. And in fact, your statement of purpose can be a single sentence. The purpose of this corporation is to do anything lawful under Delaware law, period.
Well, you may be right on the letter of the Delaware law, but nevertheless, since they control such a large proportion of the public's economy, I think they have a public responsibility.
So then really the issue here is what we should be doing is not so much saying that this is wrong because of some abstraction, but rather that we need to educate people. We need to create a movement. We need to get people involved in saying this is wrong, and let's write it back into law that it's wrong.
Well, I think that's true. But if you even consider this corruption on a metaphorical level, people are generally willing to tolerate and live with a certain amount of corruption if they themselves are benefiting from the practices that the management is engaging in. But that's not happening now. Average CEO pay is 300 times worker pay. That's not skimming a little. That's taking it all. And they continue to attack pensions, they continue to add pensions to themselves. One of the people here at the AFL-CIO said, the great irony is most CEOs continue to receive defined benefit plans, that's pensions, with preferential treatment.
Well, I mean, look at United. You got all the bigwigs at United are, their pensions are not being endangered.
No, they're not only not being endangered, they're being enhanced. And this goes beyond unfair. You're absolutely right. But I do think, and I think the key is an involved public. That is, any corporation can ride roughshod over a union at this point. They have the law, they have the government on their side. We fight back, but they frequently get away with it. What they can't beat is the public. Once the public becomes aroused and stays aroused on it, then corporations have to backtrack. So, yes, it is a matter of motivating people.
Now, the argument that the cons will make on this is very simple, and it's something that probably most people in America today, after 15 years of indoctrination by con right-wingers like Limbaugh and whatnot, can recite from memory. The con take on this is, well, if you allow labor unions and whatnot to come in and rule, and you have minimum wage laws, and you cut down executive compensation, and that's socialism, that's communism, you're going to screw up the free market and destroy the American economy. What they fail to notice is that during that period of time when we had the highest level of unionization in the history of this country, that being from 1935 to 1980 when Ronald Reagan came into office and declared war on organized labor, when it hit its peak in 1947 at 35%, and it was at 25% of the workforce was unionized in 1980 when Reagan came in. We're down now in the private workforce to 8.5%, more or less.
That's correct.
Numbers you're using. That during that period of time when we were running from 35% down to 25%, and for every union job that's out there, there's generally an equally paying job that's not a union job. So the union jobs define the floor.
That's
so,
right.
So you had roughly half of America, in fact, arguably in the 40s and 50s and early 60s, 70% of America, where a single person was able to with a good union job, was able to feed their family, put their kids through school, have health care, have pensions, all these things. And ever since Reagan declared war on the working class and war on organized labor, we've seen that collapse. We've seen it absolutely collapse. And the result of that collapse has been the collapse of the middle class, the American middle class. It's just being wiped out. And so they come along and they say, all right, you get these unions in here and it's going to screw everything all up, quack, 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 quack. But when you look at the reality of it, the time when we had the greatest unionization and the greatest control on executive compensation was the time when the middle class was doing the best. How can that be?
Well, it's extraordinary how selective their nostalgia is. They always look back to an era before America became hopelessly corrupt, and I'm presuming they're saying morally corrupt. I don't really know what they're talking about. But they also look back to a time when exactly what you say, where the curve was far flatter. Executives did not earn obscene amounts of money,
right,
and people earned a living wage. I'm not talking about socialism. I'm talking about common decency in business practices. Moreover, what they're doing is the estimate is that upper management, through stock options, controls an average of 17% of the stock of major corporations in the United States. And this is producing what a lot of analysts call stock dilution. And it has an effect on the company. It has an effect on the company's policies as to who they benefit. Whether
right.
benefit, all right, let's leave the public out of it. It doesn't have to benefit the public. But it furthermore doesn't benefit the average stockholder, and in many cases, most cases perhaps, the average stockholder is somebody who owns through a pension fund or a mutual fund. So that the business practices of the United States are being skewed by heavy additions to an already rich executive pay.
Right. And this is the argument that actually is carrying the day in some areas. And you get folks like Elliot Spitzer talking about these kinds of issues, where they come in and they say, these executive compensation packages, all of these things, they're not just wrong. They're not just, you know, illegal. They are actually causing these corporations to be less profitable, and therefore they're a violation of their legal requirement to satisfy, to their fiduciary responsibility.
Well, it's absolutely true. And, greater enforcement of the law as it's written would certainly help, but it does take, as we've been saying, an informed populace. Not just informed. I mean, it seems as though too many people identify with upper management, wish they would get there, although their only means to there seems to be the lottery. But they don't seem to see any connection between management practices and their own situation,
right.
And this is hard to beat. So I don't know. We have a public education issue.
So what's the call for action here, Alec? We got about 20 seconds.
Yes. Continue to put the spotlight on them. I mean, make people defend their 300 times your pay.
Yeah, it's indefensible is the bottom line. I mean, and let's change the rules of the game. Let's wake people up to this and change the rules of the game. Alec Dubrow, thanks so much for being with us. He's the Mediator Coordinator for the International Labor Communications Association, ILCAOnline.org is the website, a division or an affiliated group with the AFL-CIO. Alec, thanks so much. Tom Hartman, 20 minutes past the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Left suppresses right suppresses left. So what's left? And what's right? So what to wait? Sometimes, but you don't
Okay, you're back on Connected Solid. So okay. You could have just dropped off.
Okay, we're back. I believe we're back. Yeah, hey. Okay. The magic of live radio from doing a conference here. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here at the Take Back America Conference, and I have with me Malia Zazu.
Lazu.
Lazu. Ah, there we go. Lazu. And Malia, I'm sorry, we've burned up a minute or two here being disconnected, but we've got just a couple of minutes. Real quickly, you folks just rolled out something. Tell us about it.
Yes, we just rolled out our program, citiesforprogress.org. It's a network of over 300 local elected progressive officials in cities throughout this country, and a few thousand activists that work on resolutions. We have sample resolutions. We have toolkits. It's a step in taking back America, so we are pleased to launch it here.
That is absolutely great. And people can find this on the web where?
Yep, citiesforprogress.org. And click on your state, scroll down to your city, and find out who are some city councilors who you can work with, along with some activists and organizations.
So at citiesforprogress.org, I can find out. And if somebody is a local progressive official, how do they register? How do they get on your website?
Well, the minute that you go to the website and you don't see yourself, I want to remind you, don't be mad at me. I just don't know you yet. So there's a button that you can hit, and it'll say, you know, hey, meet me, and they'll be vetted. We do have certain criteria that we put, you know, up, and then they'll be up on the web. So if you are not on there and you know you're progressive, please let me know so I can know you.
That's absolutely great. And you just rolled that out here today at the Take Back America Conference.
Yes, we did. We had 5 city councilors from throughout the country and 10 activists down getting ready to roll. So citiesforprogress.org.
Cities for Progress, CitiesForProgress.org.
Thank you so much, Tom. I appreciate
Malia,
it.
Malia?
Malia.
Malia, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank
I appreciate
you.
It. 29 minutes past the hour.
This is the Democracy Zone with Tom Hartman.
And welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Oh, it's General Madness at the Take Back America Conference. To the folks in the chat room and to the folks back at KPOJ in Portland, I've just lost all my connections to the Internet. I'm sorry. We will be hopefully back up at some point here shortly. In fact, let me just try the connect button here. The general madness. But it's going to take me a couple of minutes to recover, and I can't do that when I'm live on the air. So we will simply go back to talking about the issues of the day, which is, you know, really what I think is a good plan anyway. Yesterday at Arlington National Cemetery, well, this wasn't yesterday, actually, a few days ago, Arlington National Cemetery, Memorial Day, George W. Bush, at our national cemetery, we get comfort from knowing that the men and women who are serving freedom's cause understand their purpose and its price. Yet the reality has been that the administration that most recently has sent those men and women to fight for freedom's cause, notes the Center for American Progress, has failed to live up to government's age-old promise to care for him who shall have borne the battle and for his widow and for his orphan. Howdy. We are... I hate to say that again. Oh, John. Hey. Would you like to be a guest on our program? Let me just bring you in here. This is John Cavanaugh?
From the Institute for Policy Studies.
You know, I
right?
always pronounce that Kavanaugh.
That's okay.
I was getting it wrong
close.
All these years.
Congratulations on your book, by the way.
Which book?
The book on corporations.
Oh, on equal protection.
Yes.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Terrific book.
Thank you. You've been a guest on our program before.
Yes, I have.
And I mispronounced your name then,
too?
No,
you didn't. No, you got it right. You got
okay.
it right.
John Cavanaugh. Tell us, what are you folks up to today?
Well, today, the Institute for Policy Studies has just launched this terrific new network, Cities for Progress. We pulled together city council officials from across the country with activists to build a different kind of power. Well, we all know that there are a lot of progressives in cities across the country. In fact, if you look at, say, an effort like the effort to defeat the Patriot Act, 400 cities passed resolutions against it. Our job with Cities for Progress is to help these people come together to coordinate and to magnify their message on a national level. So we just launched it. We launched it with campaigns against Walmart, for universal health care and a campaign to bring the troops home.
Wow, that's a lot.
That's a lot.
That's a whole lot. In fact, you put your headphones on, you can perhaps hear a little better what's going on here. So there's a website for this, or are you doing this off the Institute's website?
Well, you can either go to www.ips-dc.org, or you can go to citiesforprogress.org. It's a great website because what it does is, let's say you're from Tacoma Park, Maryland. You can hit Maryland on the map. You can hit Tacoma Park. You can learn what progressive city council resolutions have been passed in your city. You can learn what other cities have done this. You can look at model legislation if you want to encourage your city council to pass a resolution. So we're doing this on the whole range of issues, but we are focusing in particular this year on keeping Walmart out of big cities, on helping cities create the momentum for universal health care, and having cities, as they did with the build-up to the war in Iraq, have cities become a major pressure to bring the troops home.
Now, Malia was just on the program.
Right.
And is this the exact same website that she was on?
So it's the same one, Cities for Progress. Malia is the co-director of the Cities for Progress site. We at IPS are simply hosting it. We are the secretariat of Cities for Progress.
That's marvelous, John. What else is the Institute up to these days?
We're doing, well, on Walmart, we're doing a great deal on corporations.
Yeah.
We're trying to help people intelligently fight the biggest corporations in the world, like Walmart, and to think through what are viable alternatives to the Walmart model. Both how you create enough citizen pressure to force big companies like Walmart to treat their workers well, to treat the environment well, but how you can change the incentive structure of government so that smaller companies, rooted companies, companies that treat their workers well and treat the environment well, get much more of a step on things in the country, have much more of a step up on large corporations. We want to turn on its head a series of incentives that make big corporations what they are today, which is not good for America.
So we're talking about changing the rules of the game by which the game of business is played.
Exactly. I think a lot of people in America think giant corporations are inevitable. And what they don't realize is that giant corporations are here because they've been given a lot of government subsidies, a lot of incentives. For years, corporations have been given the upper hand, big corporations, under that old notion, that old 1952 notion, where the head of General Motors said before a Senate committee, what's good for General Motors is good for America and vice versa. You could make
the and vice versa part doesn't normally get
and vice versa. And in 1952, you could make an argument. General Motors was employing people. It was bringing African Americans into the workforce. It was paying taxes. Today, General Motors is doing none of those things. What's good for America is no longer what's good for these big corporations and vice versa. What's good for America is rebuilding our economies from the bottom up based on firms that are rooted, that are in communities, that are reinvesting in communities, and you can do it. These big companies aren't big because they're smarter. They're big because the rules have been made to favor them.
Right. And so what can just while you guys are doing this, be very careful of, don't drop my ISDN connection again. the wonders of live radio. So let's talk about the practical realities of this. We're talking about changing the rules of the game.
Right.
Corporations are chartered on a state level.
Right.
And yet there are federal laws as well, the Sherman Act probably being the most famous, that regulate corporate behavior. Where's the pressure point that you see?
Well, I would say the pressure point, like most things, there are pressure points locally, at the state level, nationally, and globally. Obviously, since corporations are chartered at the state level, it's a great place to start. If we could work with our state legislators to rewrite the language in the charters that give corporations their right to exist, and if we could put in language into those charters which...
It's more like Robert Hinckley's.
Robert Hinckley has pioneered this, and I'm sure you've spoken about it many times, but language that simply require companies to serve the common good, to serve the public interest.
Language that was in the corporate charter
agreements, as it were, or information on every corporation in America and every state in the United States from the founding of this republic until the 1890s during the chartermongering
era.
Let's just go back to what worked before, what helped build America to be an industrial powerhouse.
Right. And I think at a local level, we're working a lot with city councils. City councils can do a lot to say, okay, if you're going to come into our city, if you're going to be a big box store like Walmart, you got to pay a living wage. You've got to give back to the community. There's a lot that can happen at that local level. And at the national level, and it's interesting, you know all these polls, the vast majority of Americans think that corporations have too much political and economic power. So we've got to rein it in at both levels. Politically, we have to push the campaign finance reform thing much further. And just as an aside, it's the same battle in every country around the world. You get activists together from any country in the world, their number one issue is corporate influence over their political systems. So this is a fight. You're not alone in this fight.
Now, John Cavanaugh with the Institute for Public Policy Studies. This is really at the bottom of what just happened in France, is it not?
Absolutely. In France, for those who weren't paying attention, France over the weekend, the French people went to the polls to vote on a new European constitution. Europe is an interesting place. Europe has pulled together in a common union, which has some negative aspects, but it has some positive aspects. They much better than we here in the United States, have said, when we pull rich and poor countries together in a union, we need some social protections, we need to give some aid to the poorer countries to pull them up. But what the French were voting on Sunday was a resolution to create a constitution for Europe, which would increase corporate power, corporate mobility, a sort of corporate Europe. And people in France said, we don't want that.
Right.
We believe we like our French culture. We like a French economy that is rooted here in France. We like sheep farmers in France. We like small communities. We don't want to be swallowed up by giant corporations. It's a stunning move, which doesn't destroy the notion of a union in Europe,
sure,
but it stops in its track a corporate agenda to strengthen the union for corporations.
Right. In many ways, they're playing out the argument that was being played out in the Federalist Papers
exactly
230 years
absolutely
ago. These same issues are being debated. It's almost like deja vu. You know,
it is, and I give the Europeans credit that with progressive political parties, with strong social movements, they have a much more intelligent, and with a more independent media, they have a more intelligent conversation going on there about how you both preserve locally what is important to people, but you create a common set of standards. I mean, in Europe, one of the great things about the European Union is they are trying to harmonize up standards for maternal health benefits, for worker rights, and so on. They are trying to create a social union that makes people stronger and better and makes their lives better. And at the same time, they are trying now, with this vote in France, to keep corporations from ruining that.
Right. And they discuss openly things like raw capitalism, what they call raw capitalism.
Absolutely. I think people in this country would do well to look to Europe for a lot of the things that can help us out. Many of us 15 years ago, when the big fight in the United States was against the creation of a corporate North American Free Trade Agreement. This was Bush 1 initiative. It was to pull together the U.S., Mexico, and Canada into a big, giant corporate alliance where our corporations could go into Mexico, exploit their workers, bring goods back. We should have looked at Europe, because Europe has done a terrific job of taking the poorer countries around the periphery, Portugal, Spain, Ireland, and helping to pull them up by giving them aid, by having common standards, rather than our effort with Mexico and the rest of Latin America, where we give corporations free rein, we don't put any checks on them, and we have a race to the bottom.
Yeah, absolutely. And how do you respond to the folks who, you know, the cons who say, you know, we can't have control of this kind of stuff. We can't have control of corporations. That's socialism. That's communism. My response to it is, that's democracy. I'm sorry. If we the people decide that these are the rules of the game, that's not, you know, you can put any ism on you want. That's democracy. But what's your rebuttal?
My take would be exactly the same. Our corporate structures that now have so much influence on our lives, they aren't inevitable. They weren't creations of God. They were creations of of our fellow Americans who gave our state legislators the power to give corporations charters. The original idea is that it would be for private companies to further the common good, and the charter would be taken away when they'd finished doing that.
Right.
Corporations over the years have twisted those charters, and they've created in themselves these giants like Walmart, which are destroying the world, that are destroying democracy, destroying what we fought for as they bargain down wages and working conditions around the world. People can take that back. We do have the power to re-elect people at every level of government, to change the incentives, and to have corporate structures which serve us, not a few people sitting in Bentonville, Arkansas, who've made tons of money off of a model that is impoverishing people not only in the United States, but in countries like China as well.
Well, what about the few people who are sitting in Ohio running and owning the Diebold Corporation?
Well, so
I mean, here, you know, yes, but now we have corporations holding our votes.
Holding our votes. Certain things should not be put in the private sector. One of them is how we run our elections and the technology to carry out our elections. Countries around the world, and all we have to do is look north to Canada, have figured out how through complete public control to do elections better and to do it in a much more open and transparent way where every voter knows that their vote was counted and it did count. We should never let private corporations into the direct business of helping to run our democracy.
Right, and we have.
And we have.
And how do we get them out?
We get them out through a citizen upheaval. I will say one of the most exciting things to me that is happening this year is that people from all walks of life, labor unions, environmental groups, health groups, other groups are coming together around the biggest company in the world, Walmart. We just brought city officials into this. If we can create a national debate over Walmart, and it's not just about this company, it's about the model it represents, the race to the bottom model that it represents, I think we can have a real conversation about the kinds of rules, laws, and incentives that we need to pass to take America back from these corporations.
And how do we get that word out?
We
have a progressive media emerging here.
We have
There's
a progressive
the Internet.
Media.
But yeah. Still, you've got a situation where, for example, on MSNBC, it seems that the old rule that Jeff Cohen told us about when he was producing Donahue, that if you have a progressive on, you have to have two conservatives.
Right.
If you have a middle of the, quote, moderate,
right.
You know, a moderate, you right. know, like what, Pat Buchanan or something? I mean, you know, that you have to have a conservative to balance them. You know, Adolf Hitler's, I don't know. It's like, you know, how do you deal with this? I mean, what are we going to do?
Oh, listen, there are, the media of tomorrow, of 5 years from now, won't look anything like the media of today. There's a lot more spaces, like your own radio show, to get the word out. We need much more resources to go into that, but my other big plea to progressives is, don't give up on the mainstream media. They sell, despite their corporate control, they sell newspapers, they sell radio programs because of controversy. We have to make ourselves part of that story. We are part of that controversy. If you have a great fight against Walmart, you can get in there. Don't give up that space. Don't say to yourself, I will never get in, it's corporate controlled. They need you. They view it as entertainment.
Yeah. Don't give it up. Well, and in fact, the largest distributor of progressive talk radio in America right now, over 90% of all people who listen to progressive talk radio in the United States are listening on a Clear Channel station.
There you go.
I mean, go figure.
Right? Go figure. So, only in America.
So, yeah, what's the definition of a capitalist? Somebody will sell you the rope to hang. You'll use to hang them with. That's
right.
But hopefully nobody gets hung in all this.
Right.
The bottom line is that what's good for ultimately America can be good for corporate America. Right,
right.
John?
Great.
John Cavanna. The Institute for Policy Study, IPS.org?
IPS-DC.org.
IPS-DC.org. John, thanks so much for being with
my
us.
My pleasure.
I appreciate it.
Great to join
it's,
you.
It's 10 minutes before the hour. I'm Tom Hartman.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friends. Tom Hartman here with you. Thank you, Leanne. Hey, Rob, have a seat. And welcome back. We are broadcasting live from the Take Back America Conference. If you go to
RadioRow.net. You can actually see live pictures of Radio Row, which is the broadcasting area here. Great fun. And our telephone number, 1-866-889-8894. If you don't want to drop into our live chat, I just got back in there. We finally got our internet connections back up. Go to TomHartmann.com and click live chat. That will get you in there. And we have with us Rob Call of OpEdNews.com. Hey, Rob.
Hey, Tom. How you doing?
Great. The last I heard from you, you were on a vessel being boarded by the Coast Guard. Do you
want Yes. We were fishing on the Delaware and in our little boat, and this big cutter comes up with its double giant engines, the four guys with guns.
Uh-huh.
And we had our fishing rods.
Your Homeland Security dollars at work.
Oh, yeah.
What is this, just random stuff?
I think so. Yeah, it's the beginning of the season, and they were out checking, and we were fortunate. We had everything we needed, but then a little later they took something a little bit bigger than a rowboat with a family, with kids, and they towed him.
It was so strange because Louise called you, and she says, I got Rob on the phone, and you're going, I can't talk, we're being boarded by the Coast Guard. Oh, no! It's like they're starting the roundup. they're going after the progressive bloggers. Okay, what's the hot news on opednews.com?
The hot news on Op-Ed News.
Well, let me alternatively. What's hot here at the conference? I've been on the air for 5.5 hours.
I just got here.
You just got here. What are the things you're looking forward to today?
I just want to see where everybody's heads are at, really. Where it's post-election. This is the first really big meeting since the election, and I want to see what's going to happen, where people are heading. I want to see leadership. That's really important. I really feel we're flailing right now. The biggest action I've seen out there is DFA right now, probably, Democracy for America.
Right.
And I'd like to see some faces and names of people who really stand out as being leaders and making a difference. We desperately need that now.
You were here a year ago.
I was here 2 years ago.
2 years ago. Okay. And the conference seems to have grown quite a bit since then. So
has it? I don't know.
Yeah. Okay. Well, it's moving along. In any case, Rob Call's been with us. OpEdNews.com, another one of the great online news sites for progressive news. Thanks a lot, Rob.
Thanks, Tom.
Tom Hartmann with you.
Been listening to the Tom Hartmann program? Check our website at www.tomhartmann.com for archives of this program and more information. Rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded. Here's Tom Hartmann.
And welcome back, my friends. Tom Hartmann here with you, broadcasting live on radio stations from California to West Virginia, beaming down from outer space on the Sirius satellite radio system, streaming around the planet on radiopower.org, Live 365's American FM, WhiteRoseSociety.org, and on cable systems in 29 states on CRN Digital. Welcome back to our program. And special greetings to our newest affiliate, Radio Free Ohio in Akron, Ohio. We have with us Josh, is it Ernest?
Yes, that's correct.
Ernest, just like it sounds. The press secretary to the DNC.
That's right.
And what a job. You must be like the guy with all the plates spinning in the air, you know, running around trying to keep all of them going at the same time.
We have a few things going on today, but certainly the gathering here this afternoon and for the next couple of days is certainly one of the most important.
Well, that I'm pleased to hear that, because this is an overtly progressive meeting, sort of the progressive equivalent of an overtly conservative meeting that Republicans show up at, you know.
They have a few of those, don't they?
Yeah, they do, yeah. And there is, you know, there has been this schism or split in the Democratic Party. At least, you know, correct me if I'm wrong. This is how it looks from the outside looking in. That historically, the Democratic Party, which was founded by Thomas Jefferson, the oldest and longest lasting political party in the history of the world, the party that has been
relentlessly under attack from Republicans. In fact, if you go to whitehouse.gov right now, you know who the first Democratic presidents were, I assume.
Sure.
Okay, so you got Jefferson, Madison, Monroe, and who followed him? Jackson.
Right.
The first four. If you go on the whitehouse.gov website, all of their biographies have been rewritten, and they are all now Republicans.
Is that right?
Honest to God. The Republican Party did not come into being until 1856 in Jackson, Michigan, the
Something
Republican
like that,
Party
right.
was founded. And yet, whitehouse.gov, read the biographies of, just look at James Madison's biography, right there, James Madison, a Republican president.
Well, they say that the imitation is the highest form of flattery, right? So I guess
well,
we should all be very flattered.
This is not imitation, this is theft. But in any case, the point, to get back to my original point, it's great to hear you say that you're glad to be here, because a lot of people are very concerned that the Republicans had historically been in the pocket of big business. In fact, many would argue the Republican Party wasn't formed as a big business party. It was formed as a reform party, as an abolition party, and all that sort of thing. But after the Civil War, after Lincoln's death, the railroads took over in the 1870s, and they've basically been the party of big business ever since. In the early 90s, in the late 80s, as Reagan's war on organized labor and war on working people in America was succeeding, and unionization had dropped from the 25% it was under Reagan, when Reagan first came into office, down to the 8% it is now, as that was dropping, the Democratic Party was looking around going, hey, we've traditionally gotten money from working people through the unions. We no longer have access to as much of that. Where are we going to go? Where's the money? Well, the money was with the corporations. And so Bill Clinton and a bunch of other people, with the best of intentions, let's keep the Democratic Party
sure.
alive, said, hey, the money's with the corporations. Let's get in bed with them. And thus, the Democratic Leadership Council, and thus the people that we refer to now as Democratic moderates, I would refer to them as Republicans, or Republican light.
Right.
So talk to me a minute about that schism. I mean, here you are, you're an official with the Democratic
sure.
Party. How does the Democratic Party view this battle for the heart and soul of the Democratic Party?
You know, from the DNC perspective, I think that we view it as our job at the DNC to keep our family together. I think one of the strengths of our party is our diversity, whether it's our racial diversity, whether it's the diversity of the age groups that represent our party, whether it's the diversity in gender, and I also think it's the diversity in philosophy. I think that our party is stronger because we include people from different parts of the philosophical spectrum in our party and give them a voice and give them an opportunity to be heard. So it is important for me to be here because a significant portion of our party describes themselves as progressives, and that's an important part of our party and something we can't turn our back on. And clearly, it's just the opposite. We need to make sure that their views are represented in our party.
Yeah.
And I think the same would be true, of the so-called moderates. At the base, there are certainly some things we disagree on, and no one should paper over those and act like those don't exist. But our fundamental philosophies are the same. We do have much more in common, than we disagree on. And I think it's the job of the DNC and the institution of the Democratic Party to keep those folks together. And I think a healthy debate within our party is a good thing for our party. It does make us stronger. And I think given the opportunity to a lot of different people with a lot of different philosophical views is important for our party. It keeps us moving in a positive direction, and it keeps us the dynamic organization that we are. What's important, though, is it's important for us to make sure that we don't get caught up and overwhelmed by those internal battles, and to make sure that we are focused on the goal, which is, two things. One, winning elections. I mean, this is politics, right? At the end of the day, we got to get more votes than they do.
Right.
But the second thing is making sure that we don't lose our heart and soul, that we do, that we do stay in touch with why we formed ourselves as a party in the first place. And I think all those things are important. In some ways, it's easier said than done. I think that there are times when we're more successful than others. It's the strength of our party, and so it's clearly a double-edged sword. It does mean that we fight a lot more amongst ourselves than Republicans do, but it really is the strength of our party.
Yeah. Well, would you say, let me just extend a metaphor here, and again, I realize we're talking with Josh Earnest, the press secretary to the DNC, Democratic
right.
National Committee. Would you say that it would be to the benefit of the Republican Party, if you could put on the hat of your peer in that,
sure.
in that party, to their benefit, to embrace, for example, David Duke, who says that segregation should be the law in the United States again, and that, the positions of
sure.
the KKK.
Right.
Do you think that that kind of inclusion would be a benefit to the Republican Party?
Would it benefit them? No,
right.
I think it would be great if they did that.
Significant
portions of them do.
Right, but from their point of view, if they openly embrace that, would that be of value to them?
I don't think it would be of value to their party.
Okay. I think you can see where I'm going with this.
Right.
We have, within the Democratic Party, in my opinion, you know, feel free to set me straight if I'm,
sure.
if I'm missing something here. We have folks who, when you look at who's benefiting, the multinational corporations who owe no allegiance to the United States and, in fact, are incorporating offshore as fast as they can so they don't even have to pay taxes in the United States. People, are they benefiting or are we the people, working people in the United States, small business people, medium-sized businesses, even big businesses in the United States that actually pay their taxes and stay incorporated in the United States? Who's benefiting? And we find in the Democratic Party there are members, there are people in the United States Senate, there are people in the House of Representatives, there are people, elected officials all over this country, who will consistently take the position of the multinational corporations who basically are telling America to take a leap over the interests of Americans. How is that different than the Republicans embracing David Duke?
Right. Well, I think...
you say diversity.
Right. I do think that diversity is important. I do think that, that David Duke's views are much more abhorrent and offensive than many of the moderates in our party.
But David Duke's views would never affect the mainstream of America. And these guys are wiping out the middle class. They're cutting the guts out of the middle class.
Right. I'm not going to suggest that there aren't areas where we disagree, but I am going to suggest that even those people that you cite that describe themselves as moderate do have a different vision for how to protect the interests of the middle class. But I do think that's one thing that we do have in common.
That's a good question. What is their vision, though?
Right. Yeah, I'm not sure. It's hard for me necessarily to speak for them. But, you know, if I were to guess, I would say that they think it's important to support the people that are supplying jobs in this country.
Supply jobs. Nobody supplies jobs. That's a Republican metaphor. The reality is that if there are people out there who want to buy something, then there's somebody who will start a business to sell that. And if I own a business, the only reason that I'm going to hire somebody, for, say, $10 an hour is because I know that I can make $12 an hour off their labor. If I can only make $9 an hour off their labor, I'm not going to create that factory. I'm not going to create that, quote, create that job.
Sure.
So nobody supplies jobs. Workers supply the physical and intellectual capital that allows people to make money. But nobody is supplying jobs.
That's right. But I do think we need to create an environment in which businesses feel comfortable operating here. And I think that's something that Democrats are focused on. I mean, we do want to hold companies accountable for the labor practices that they employ, not just in this country, but all around the world. Because in the end, that A, means a better product for American consumers, but it also means better jobs for American workers.
Yeah.
We have lots of built-in advantages here. We have a remarkable education system, certainly needs a lot of improvement, but certainly is, in many cases, is better than the world.
It's under assault by conservatives.
That's true. And I think that's one of the reasons that I think that we've seen a decline in some of the educational infrastructure in this country because of that.
Yeah.
But job training programs, again, that are also under assault by Republicans, but also give American workers a leg up. These are the types of programs that are supported by Democrats that train folks to do a good job at their job,
right.
To be trained on the latest equipment, to have the latest training to do their jobs safely, to do the jobs more efficiently. Those are the types of programs that I think that, again, this may be a pretty good example of where all Democrats can agree on.
Yeah.
Some that would describe themselves as progressives, others that would describe themselves as moderates. But we have a situation which we know that if we invest in workers, if we give them the training that they need, if we make sure that their employers treat them fairly and offer them health care, and other things to make sure that they are treated fairly, that they can earn a livable wage and provide for their families.
Now, there's an area where the United States is at a significant disadvantage, because the United States is the only country in the industrialized world where employers and employees fund health care. In every other
That's
country
right.
in the world, the funding of healthcare is considered part of the commons, and so it's funded by all economic activity, individual and corporate together, just like the police departments are and fire departments are and things like that. Is the Democratic Party going to take a position on single-payer national health care or national health care?
Sure. Speaking for the DNC, which is my job as a press secretary, we don't necessarily take specific views on specific policy stances, on specific policy prescriptions.
Right.
But it certainly is a value of our Democratic Party to expand health care coverage.
Yeah.
It is an abomination. It is immoral for there to be up to 50 million Americans in this country right now that don't have health insurance.
Yeah.
It is an abomination, and it's something that the Democratic Party, progressives and moderates, are committed to addressing.
Uh-huh.
I think we all have lots of different ideas about how to actually do that. There's no question that everybody within our party thinks that we do need to find a way to expand coverage.
Mm-hmm.
The fact is the same can't be said of Republicans.
Yeah.
There are Republicans who think it's more important for these Fortune 500 companies to enjoy, you know, an extra percentage point or two in profit margin than it is for them to provide decent health care coverage for their employees. That is a fundamental disagreement between Democrats and Republicans.
Yeah.
And that is a great example of where we can sort of work together as a party to achieve a goal. It also has a side benefit of being a pretty popular initiative, so hopefully that's going to win us some elections, too.
Oh, well said. You're an articulate spokesperson. I'm impressed.
Oh, thank you.
We've got about 2 minutes here left.
Sure.
Let's talk about Social Security.
Okay.
What's going on here with the Social Security debate? Is Bush, this bushwhacking of America dead in the water?
It's getting that way. We at the DNC put together a series of news releases earlier in the winter, which we described his effort to sell Americans on his Social Security privatization as death of a sales pitch. You had the President of the United States
well said,
running around all over the country, did 166 events, members of the Bush administration did 166 events in the last 3 or 4 months trying to convince the American people this is a good idea. Latest polls indicate that 60% of Americans still are adamantly opposed to Bush's privatization plan.
Well, that's actually up.
Yeah,
it was
in
the 50s, the opposition.
Right. Maybe they've been doing a better job of making the case for us than we even could have.
Apparently.
Probably true.
Do you think it might have been because their message is fundamentally flawed, or do you think that they're, by carefully scripting the things and dragging off people who have no blood for oil stickers on their cars and the basically Gestapo techniques that the Bush administration has been pursuing in these so-called town hall meetings, or Goebbels, Do you think that might have something to do with it?
I think their tactics, their hardball tactics, turn off a lot of people. But I think fundamentally, the idea that this country is going to incur another $2 trillion in debt so that people can see their health care benefits cut and the only people who really benefit are Wall Street firms, that's why this message isn't selling.
Or their retirement benefits.
Their retirement benefits, right.
Yeah. Well said. Okay, Josh Earnest, Press Secretary to the DNC. I'm impressed. You do good.
Thank you, Tom. I appreciate it.
Keep up the good work and keep spreading the message. And may your party regain the House, the Senate, and the White House soon.
With your help, we will.
Okay. Thanks a lot, Josh. I appreciate it. Tom Harbin here with you, 20 minutes past the hour.
Democracy to the United States of America. Here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friends. Tom Hartman here with you, broadcasting live from the Democracy for America Conference in Washington, D.C. Ellen Ratner with the Talk Ready News Service with us, the folks who are putting on the Radio Row, radioRow.net. If you want to see the pictures from this thing, you can see. Smile at the camera and wave, Ellen.
That's right.
There it is. Anyhow, Ellen, what's happening?
That was actually Jay Tamboli's and my invention.
Really?
Yeah. We came up with that idea, and we did the cameras, and then we bought the name. And actually, Michael Harrison owns the name, but it's
not
one partnership.
Shabby.
Yeah.
That's great.
Okay. A few things happening. The SEC chair has resigned. Now, there's also another resignation on the SEC. Two people who are very, very heavy in enforcement.
Mm-hmm.
And what we think that means is that they are getting a lot of pressure. They're not well-liked. The current Donaldson was not well-liked by industry.
Let's pause for just a minute. The SEC is the Securities and Exchange Commission. These are the guys who are supposed to oversee corporate malfeasance. In fact, the first head of the SEC was Joe Kennedy. And Gloria Swanson was an old friend of mine when she was alive. And we used to have dinner together in New
York.
Yeah, whenever I got into town. She had been a vegetarian since 1929, and I had started this. Well, it's a whole long story. But in any case, she dated Joe Kennedy, and she hated Joe Kennedy, I will add. And she used to love to tell me Joe Kennedy stories. And she made the remark once that Roosevelt, and I guess this is not a secret. This has been said by other people in other places. And that Joe Kennedy himself told this story. He told it to her. That Roosevelt had said that he made Joe Kennedy the head of the SEC because it took a crook to catch a crook. But in any case, the SEC is supposed to catch the corporate crooks.
That's right.
And all of a sudden now, the SEC are the two top people in the SEC are suddenly doing a rats evacuating the ship routine?
Well, that's right. It's actually one of the commissioners and the top guy. Now, and these were considered the two top enforcers of of really trying to clean it up.
Yeah.
And now these guys are going, and the question is, did they get pressure? Are they not being supported for their enforcement? And are they saying, hey, I'm not going to participate in a sham? And we don't know yet, but if I was a betting woman, and, you know, we're not supposed to bet over the airwaves, I would say that's exactly what was going on with these guys.
Yeah.
Now, a couple other interesting things. Mr. Rumsfeld defended what was happening today with the prisoners, with the treatments of the detainees at the Pentagon, at his press conference there, and he also warned countries that they should not give medical treatment to Zarqawi. So
Zarqawi, who is probably in, what, Afghanistan?
We don't know where he is. Afghanistan, Pakistan, maybe he's still in Iraq. He claims, they're still claiming that he's in Iraq.
Rumsfeld's going to say he's in Syria, right? A good excuse. I mean, I've been saying all along, the next war these guys want to have is not with Iran, which will give them a real war. It's with Syria.
I'm going to embed because I have never had a meal like I've had in my life that I had in Syria, I'll tell you.
Oh, really?
The food would be great.
Yeah. There's some excellent food in the Middle East there.
Oh, my God. But Syria. I mean, I know I'm waxing and waning. The artichokes were as large as a football.
Wow.
I mean, I've never seen anything like it in my life. Wow. And I just did my genetic code. You know, you can call family DNA and... I got some Syrian Arab blood in me, so or some matches, so
yeah.
You never can tell.
Yeah, you never. It was going home for you.
That's right.
Better not let Don Rumsfeld know.
Oh,
about
I know that.
You'll end up in Guantanamo.
I will, and then my brother will have to get me out. I've gotten a lot of stuff on the air lately. People asking me, "Is that your brother who's arranging for all the people and to get lawyers?"
Yeah, who's suing Rumsfeld in Germany?
Yes.
Yeah, and it is your brother.
That is true. Yeah.
You know, in fact, he's been on this program before.
Right.
You know,
it's
Michael Renner.
Yeah. That's right.
Yeah, a good guy. Keep it all in the family.
We get a lot of... Well, he was just on O'Reilly the other day. The hate mail he got was unbelievable.
Yeah.
I mean, worse than even what I get.
Yeah.
I mean, I got something the other day that said, you know, if we hadn't won the war, if I wrote about the army was neither red nor blue and,
right.
You know, et cetera, right. Or it shouldn't be. And they said, well, you know, if our red army hadn't won, you'd be in an oven. And, I mean, people say to you is just...
Our red army?
Yeah.
So somehow, you know, the cons who are in bed with China.
Right.
You know, what's wrong with this picture?
Yeah.
They're absolutely all the time in bed with China. It's like there's nothing that the communists in China...
Never a moment, Tom Hartman.
Yeah, it's amazing. Ellen Ratter with the Talk Radio News Service. Thanks so much, Ellen, for the report for the day. Always great to have you on. And we will see you again tomorrow. And thanks for the Radio Row. In fact, we'll see you all the time. It's the Tom Hartman Program, 29 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Tell me, George.
Oh, tell me, George.
If there's any damn way that there'll ever be a day I can get on a plane.
Can I, George, please?
Without worrying about the next maniac trying to pay me back. Just because you're half insane.
Yeah, it's a problem, George.
Right-wing freak judges, $200 billion grudges. Yes, war's cooked up right from day one.
That's the Bushies for you.
Big corporations are running this nation like it never was meant to be run.
Oh, George, I hope you're having fun.
Yes, George, I hope you're having fun.
And welcome back, friends. Tom Hartman here with you, broadcasting live on radio stations from coast to coast, streaming down from outer space on the Sirius satellite radio system, beaming around the planet on radiopower.org, whiterosesociety.org, Live365's American FM, and in 29 states on cable digital systems on CRN Digital. At CRN.com, I think it is. Anyhow, Bob Furtick is with us, and I'm always mispronouncing your last name. It's the problem of having learned German and learned it badly, apparently. Bob is the founder, director, big cheese, grand poobah, CEO, and webmaster, I think.
No, everything but that.
You've delegated that of Democrats.com.
And welcome to the program here, Bob.
Thank you, Tom. Pleasure to be with you.
What is up with Democrats.com right now?
Well, the main thing we're working on now is step one towards impeachment.
Okay, with the through the John Conyers route?
Through the John Conyers, John Bonifaz resolution of inquiry.
Yeah.
After DowningStreet.org route.
Yeah, there you go. After DowningStreet.org. Let's say it one more time. We've been doing this for several days now on the program. And so where do you think that's going to go?
Well, I think the reaction that we're getting over the Internet is huge. We've got a contact Congress, write your representative. We've gotten 5,000 people writing their members within the first day, and it's probably 10 or 15,000 3 days late. So we know there's feeling in the grassroots. We've just been through Memorial Day. People have had a moment to reflect about the 1,600-plus American soldiers who have been killed in Iraq. And I got an email from one of the family members of somebody who died, you know, upset at us because we were pointing out the fact that their loved one died because George Bush lied to them, lied to the country.
Yeah.
It's very painful for people to grapple with the idea that the commander-in-chief misled us into a war and that it's been so tragic.
Yeah.
But
people would rather hang on to a fantasy that allows, a fantasy that contains some integrity, than embrace the horrible reality that George Bush lied us into this war so that Republicans could take control of Congress in 2002 and that he could get himself reelected in 2004. I mean, Bob Woodward lays it right out in his book that Karl Rove went down to Texas and said, here's your election strategy. You know, you're going to be a war. No sitting president during time of war in the history of the United States has ever failed to get reelected. And you know, and then you throw in the bonuses if you get to show that your daddy was a wimp and Bush hates his father. You throw in the second bonus that you get to all that oil, and there's, you know, we need a little oil here, just ask Dick Cheney. And you throw in the bonus that, you know, you get to trash the Democrats and take apart Social Security and everything else that comes with power, and what do you have?
But think about what we're saying, because we're saying, you know, we can say this because we're political kinds of people, but there are 1,600 families that are missing a loved one.
I know.
Because of what we're talking about. And to make that connection...
Not just 1,600, more like 100,000.
Well, okay. And, you know, and to say that it was cynical, to say that the motive was malevolent, which is what you and I would agree, is really a heart-rending thing to say to somebody.
Yeah, it's very difficult, very difficult. I'm looking at Democrats.com right now. Demands congressional inquiry into Bush's Iraq war lies is at the top. Catapulting the propaganda. Mark Felt on Deep Throat. What do you think about that?
I think it's great. I think it's very interesting, you know, because those of us who are old enough to remember the era think of the as Richard Nixon as the bad guy in all of this.
Right, yeah.
And Mark Felt, obviously one of the good guys in all of this. Now we're watching in the blogosphere all the right-wingers trying to turn everything on its head.
Oh, they're doing to him the same thing they did to Richard Clark and to Paul O'Neill. And yeah.
Makes you think that if we had blogging back then, at least right-wing blogging, Richard Nixon would probably still be in power.
That's a scary thought. That's a scary thought. Well, Bob, any final thoughts you want to leave with us?
I think we're at a turning point. I think, you know, people are starting to reflect on where we've been and where we're going. And, you know, it's going to take some deep thinking and some painful rethinking as a country to grapple with what we've been put through. But I think it's going to happen, and I think this is really just the start of that. I think this inquiry on the Downing Street memo will get us started. And I think 3 months from now we could have a very different conversation.
Great. I hope so. I really think the pendulum swings back and forth, and we're swinging back, you know, back from insanity to sanity. I mean, that's my perspective on it, but I really think it's happening. Bob, thanks so much for being with us. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
And thanks for coming by. Bob Furtick, F-E-R-T-I-K, right? Democrats.com, and a great website. Go check it out right now if you have an opportunity. And thanks so much for being with us, Bob. Next, we have Celinda Lake. Celinda is one of the Democratic Party's leading strategists. She's served as a tactician and senior advisor to the National Party Committees, dozens of Democratic incumbents, and challengers at all levels of the electoral process, and Democratic parties in several Eastern European countries and South Africa. That's quite remarkable. Here you go, Celinda. There's your headphones. And welcome.
Thank you very much.
I'm so pleased to have you here with us. You're one of the leading political strategists of the Democratic Party. What is the Democratic Party's strategy?
Well, I don't know that I can speak for the whole Democratic Party, but
what are you advising them?
Let me say that I think that there are a couple of things. One is to seize the moment. I think we're in a very unique moment where the president has really spent a lot of his political capital, overreached his capital, where he and his party are focused on the wrong priorities for the country, and where most of his solutions and proposals do not meet with approval by the majority of Americans. So this is an opportune moment for the Democrats and for progressives. And secondly, I would say that the Democrats entered after the 2004 elections with some deficits, and we need to fix those deficits. Most notably,
not just financial deficits.
Actually, financially, we probably did better than we had done in the past. But we need to offer a viable economic alternative, and I think that's the number one challenge for progressives and Democrats. And I think this conference is a great opportunity to kick that off and to start to talk about what our economic alternative is in the global
economy.
For example. Well, for example, we need to talk about that there are two Americas emerging, one for the wealthy and privileged, one for the rest of us, that a number of the economic policies that are out there make no sense for this country to be strong.
Unless you're part of the wealthy and privileged.
That's right, and maybe not even then. Okay. But tax cuts to send jobs overseas, that doesn't make any sense.
If you're a member of the Walton family, for example,
right.
Most of your income comes from operations in China, or
that's
if you're
right.
Dick Cheney, and most of your income comes from Halliburton, which has reincorporated its most profitable division, KBR, and offshore,
that's
so
right.
that they don't have to pay U.S. taxes.
That's right.
I mean, then it does make sense
that's
to be
right.
to be a traitor to the United States, essentially, economically,
right.
anyway speaking.
That's right. And we shouldn't be providing incentives for that kind of behavior. In fact, we should be penalizing that kind of behavior.
How'd they get away with this, Linda?
Well, I think they run the country, and I think we should take it back.
I mean, back in the mid '40s, when Prescott Bush, George Herbert Walker
right.
Bush's father, was caught, his bank was caught trading with Hitler.
Right.
Franklin Roosevelt publicly denounced it, and it was in the New York Times.
Right.
I mean, that he had lost his business
right.
over this.
Right.
And now you've got, you know, Dick Cheney's company was dealing with Saddam Hussein. They were illegally dealing with Iran. I mean,
yeah.
you know, right up until like last year or something. I'm running out. You know, there's a certain point where I almost get speechless about it. You go through the catalogs of the crimes
yeah.
of these folks, and how are they able to get away with this kind of stuff? What has happened to our media, Celinda?
Well, I think part of it, and you answered the right question, which is our media is also owned by a lot of these companies, and there aren't enough voices like your program providing the truth-telling, providing the alternative, providing the information for voters. Voters' cynicism about Congress is rivaled only by their cynicism about the media, and
yeah.
they're both at all-time lows. And people are very, very concerned that they don't really know what's going on. Their own common sense tells them something's not working here. And then I think they think that often the elites are on in both parties are too tied up with these special interests. And I think it's time for the Democrats to show that we're not. We're willing to take them on.
Hmm. And we are?
I think we are.
Okay.
Now, no one ever questioned whether Governor Dean was willing to take people on.
That's true. He was. I lived in Vermont for 10 years. He
there
was my
go.
Governor for much of that time, and it was actually very interesting to watch his evolution
uh-huh.
because he started out as basically a Rockefeller Republican
yeah.
Democrat, as
yeah.
a very moderate Democrat, and finally he got it.
Yeah.
I mean, you could just see the awakening of Howard Dean.
Interesting.
It was fascinating to watch. I mean, you know,
and I think he's got it even more as he looked nationally because, you know, Vermont is still dominated by pretty good people and
yeah.
pretty good interests. I mean, if Ben & Jerry's is one of your bigger corporate interests,
yeah.
and, you know,
well,
you're
actually,
in pretty
they got
good shape.
They got bought out by
I know.
You know, a company
sad.
In Belgium or wherever it is, yeah. So you also have done work with several Eastern European countries.
Mm-hmm.
I was fascinated to see that the effort in the Ukraine, the you know take back the Ukraine sort of thing, that it was a group of people from Serbia who actually
yeah.
did that they were funded by the Democratic and Republican parties in the United States,
right.
that they had developed a logo, the ticking clock, they had developed a slogan, "His time is up." They had developed, you know, colors. I mean, they had branded this thing all
right.
before the election because
yeah.
they were anticipating election fraud, and they put into place exit polls to prove the fraud.
Right. Why doesn't the Democratic Party start right now planning to do the exact same thing in 2006 when the Republicans try to steal these elections in 2006?
Well, it's a really good point. We should. And I think that, frankly, the way to start that is we ought to think about electing progressive secretaries of state. These secretaries of state have enormous power over the elections in their areas, and we need to have that those offices in control of people that will make sure that everybody gets to vote and everybody's vote is counted.
And that the machines that are counting the votes in secret, saying to us, you know, you have no right to look at what's in this machine, are no longer...
That's right. And the machines that are tied by contributions to certain interests within the election, which ought to be completely made illegal.
And so do you think it's possible that in the United States we could actually create enough of an infrastructure that there could be a reaction in the United States to a stolen election? Let me back up just a little bit. We know now that the 2000 election was stolen in Florida. It was stolen by Catherine Harris and Jeb Bush conspiring to throw somewhere between 50 and 100,000 African-Americans off the voter rolls.
That's right.
We also know, and it was on the front page of the New York Times and the Washington Post, you know, contrary to what Rush Limbaugh says, we know that when the news organizations got together and actually counted the vote in Florida, and actually counted the whole vote, the count that the Supreme Court stopped, that by any measure, dimpled chads, pregnant chads, hanging chads, intent of the voter, by any measure, if you counted the votes of every single citizen in the state of Florida, Al Gore won that election in Florida. We know that for a fact. This is not speculation. This is not conspiracy theory. So Al Gore actually won the vote in Florida, number one. And number two, it was, and even if he hadn't won it, he would have lost as a result of theft. There was no uprising. There was no revolt. Now comes 2004. Have you read the Conyers Commission report? And so here, John Conyers goes down to Ohio. The senior ranking, the senior Democrat, the ranking Democrat on the House Judiciary Committee, convenes this panel, calls witnesses who come in and testify, and they have the vote. George Bush became president as a result of about 60,000 people in the state of Ohio voting Republican instead of Democratic. And John Conyers documents several hundred thousand stolen votes, 100% of them that flipped from Democratic to Republican, including thousands that were documented to have been ripped off in voting machines. Why? So you know, it certainly looks to me like we've had two stolen elections, and who knows what happened in 2002. I mean, down in Georgia, you had the, you know, a few months after the state of Georgia went all electronic voting machines, no paper trails. Max Cleland is beat by Saxby Chambliss. I lived in Atlanta for 14 years. I'll tell you, Max Cleland was beloved in Georgia. Saxby Chambliss was a draft dodger, and he ran on a campaign of he was more patriotic than Max Cleland, who left three limbs in Vietnam. The exit polls, the pre-polls, the post-polls all showed Cleland winning by 3 to 5 points, and yet Saxby Chambliss won by 3 points, according to the voting machines. I think that election was stolen. Why has there not been that orange revolution in the United States? Is it just because we don't have those six guys from Serbia with the support of the Democratic and Republican Party?
Well, you know, it's a really good question. And I actually think it's good that we don't have a revolution in this country and that we have that kind of stability and that people accept the results. On the other hand, I think they should be better served. What we need to do is insist.
Wait a minute. Did you just say it's a good thing that a stolen election gets accepted by the people?
Well, I'm not sure that I think that 2004, honestly, and 2002 were stolen. I do think that 2000 was stolen. And I do think that there are substantial questions here that ought to be answered and that we ought to avoid in the future. The major thing that I think we ought to focus on is how to make sure this doesn't happen again and again and again. And look at the litany that you're talking about. Look at the number of votes that are being thrown out. This is ridiculous. You wonder why people don't want to vote. Why would you?
So why doesn't the Democratic Party right now hire those guys from Serbia and say, hey, listen, we want to be ready for when this happens, because we've seen, you know, we've seen 8 or 10 years, really, if you go back and look, of aggressive campaigns of vote fraud by the Republican Party. It's time to change it.
Well, I don't know if we've seen... I don't know if we
Well, whether we have or not.
I don't know if we need the Serbians, although I think we could appreciate their help, and I'd love to.
But let's just do it ourselves.
Right. I think what we need is we need to invest in elections. We need to insist that we're not going to do elections I mean, this is the most technologically advanced country in the world. We're not going to do elections this way. And secondly, we need to insist on every vote being counted.
Yeah, absolutely. I'd like to talk with you about some of the issues before us, too, if you can stick around for a minute.
Sure.
Okay, we have a break we're going to go to. This is the Tom Hartman Radio Program, the radio support group of, by, and for we the people of the United States of America. Stick around. We'll be right back. 10 minutes before the hour.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
Got to go back. We've got to go back.
And welcome back, my friends. Tom Hartman here with you, 5 minutes before the hour. The Tom Hartman Radio Program, the radio support group of, by, and for We the People. We're talking with Celinda Lake, a Democratic Party strategist, tactician, and senior advisor. Celinda, tell me about progressive taxation.
Well, the progressive tax plan says that the current tax plan isn't working at all unless you're wealthy. And the so-called tax cuts didn't materialize for the working middle class, which is increasingly disappearing. What we said is we ought to have no more additional tax cuts for people who make over $200,000 or $100,000 in their family income. And we really need to use that money to shore up Social Security, to reduce the deficit, and to invest in the things that will make America stronger and better for all of us, like our schools, health care that you can count on, good-paying jobs. The second point that we make is that the tax code is riddled with the kind of exemptions that we were talking about. If you advertise your products abroad, you get to deduct that. If you ship jobs overseas, you get to deduct that. If you take your money to the Cayman Islands, you don't have to pay taxes on it. What about real America? All we've got is HBO.
Right.
I think that...
Try to reincorporate yourself in the Cayman Islands.
Right, exactly.
Say,
right.
I'm not going to pay taxes anymore. I'm now a citizen of the Caymans.
Cayman Islands. Right. I got a post office box there.
Yeah, I don't think
exactly
it'll work.
Right. So what this says is, let's get those tax loopholes closed. And then the third thing that it says is that the estate tax ought to be changed. And certainly, if you are a small business or a small farm, and you want to pass this on to your kids, that's one thing.
That should be protected.
Absolutely. But if you're Walmart, that's ridiculous.
Yeah, let's just raise the ceiling on it. I mean, right now
right.
it's $3 million. Why not make it $20
million? Right.
You're still
right.
going to catch 99% of what you catch
exactly.
right now.
Exactly.
I mean, there's only 6,000 families in America who are even going to face the estate tax this year.
Exactly. And yet the Republicans and the conservatives have used this as a total ruse and convinced everyone that we're going to be taxing you when you pass your grandmother's watch on to your niece.
Right. But they're doing it with money from the Walton family,
that's
by and
right.
large. So, who are worth $100 billion and never
and
worked a day in
their lives. And don't pay health care for their employees.
Right. Yeah.
A couple
surprise,
of percentage
surprise.
Of their profits could provide health care for every employee that they have.
Yeah. And finally, Celinda Lake, Tom DeLay.
Well, Tom DeLay is an interesting case because, obviously, he's an extremist and a crook. The issue, I think, with Tom DeLay is to point out these abuses. They're not isolated with that individual person, but represent a whole philosophy of the party and the leadership. There's a reason we don't have decent prescription drug coverage. It's not accidental. It's because of the kind of money that Tom DeLay and the kind of trips and golf trips and family gifts that have come from the pharmaceutical industry to Tom DeLay.
Now, the article that I saw in the paper this week was about how Democrats and Republicans alike, members of Congress, are suddenly rushing to amend their trip voucher
right.
things.
Right.
And it sort of implied, oh, everybody does this, so why don't you Democrats just calm down?
Like, well, you know
is
what?
Is this part of a new PR strategy from the...
Well, and I think that...
We've just wrapped the show, I'm sorry. Thanks so much for being with us, Celinda. I appreciate
it. Thank you.
It.
Thanks a lot.
Paul had forgotten.